That worked. To set the tone for the meeting, I will read an extract from page 164 of the Big Book. Still, you may say, but I will not have the benefit of contact with you who write this book. We cannot be sure. God will determine that. So you must remember that your real reliance is always upon him. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. The topic of tonight's meeting is part four of working step 12 with a sponsee, and Tim will share anything between 30 and 45 minutes on the topic, after which the floor will be open for questions rather than the typical sharing. And with that, I will now hand over to Tim.
Evening, everyone. Tim Alcoholic. There are a couple of topics I'm going to start. I want to get them out of the way because they're sort of deadly. So there are a couple of outside issues which come up when you're sponsoring people. And the first one is the issue of psychotherapy, and the second one is the issue of psychiatry. And I'll deal with these separately. Now, I don't know about anyone else, but when I was growing up, various people tried to help me. And when they couldn't, they always said the same thing. When they ran out of things to say, they'd say, I think you should see a therapist. Now, what this means is I don't have a solution, but there is a solution somewhere. And the thing is about therapy, we talk about it in recovery a lot, as though it's a single thing. But it's like saying you need a solution, because it covers such an incredibly broad range of things, from psychoanalysis to psychotherapy to cognitive behavioral therapy to very, very targeted interventions to, and there are all sorts of skill levels, or people with different experiences, but therapists different experiences with 12-step recovery. Some are very hostile, some are very positive. So it doesn't really mean anything to say I'm in therapy, or I'm thinking about going to therapy, or you should go to therapy. It has no, like saying you have a problem, you need a solution, because it's too broad a term. But one phenomenon which is very common, where it interacts with, and I have no opinion on, one can't have an opinion on therapy per se, because it's such a broad topic, it doesn't mean anything. One has to know what therapy one's talking about. And I've certainly had therapy a number of times, and subjectively speaking, there have been some benefits. I'm not anti it at all. But where it comes up very regularly with sponsees is, now, there are some people I've known, who sponsees who've gone into therapy to deal with particular childhood questions or particular behavioural problems, particular phobias or particular compulsive behaviours. But what often happens with sponsees is they'll experience a malaise of some sort, particularly when they're partway through the process. So partway through step four, or partway through step eight, or partway through step nine. And someone suggests therapy without going into any detail about exactly what sort of therapy or why or what aspect of the problem. But it's just sort of waved as the sort of magical solution over there. And as though one, you know, everyone is necessarily missing out if one isn't having it. And I shouldn't really say this, but I'm going to. I've been to a number of meetings where the topic of the meeting becomes, so the chair mentions therapy, and then the topic of the sharing is, AA is great because it gets you physically sober, but the point of AA is to enable you to go to therapy, and that's the real answer. And I've been to meetings where you sort of suggest that you've done the AA program that solved your problems, and there's lots of head shake at the assertion that AA has anything to offer other than keeping you physically sober. And it's very disconcerting. I don't tend to go back to those meetings, but they do. There's some around here that I've been to which are like that. Now, the question with, obviously, it's up to the sponsee what they do, but I think there are a couple of considerations. There are a couple of areas of considerations which I give sponsees when they start to sort of, when they want to wave the magic therapy wand to treat their, whatever their condition is. And the first one, if you are going to, I don't know about anyone else's experience with therapy. It's very expensive unless you can get some sort of funding. You know, I've paid up to £150 an hour for a therapist. Money well spent in some cases, but nonetheless, it's a big financial commitment. One wouldn't spend, you know, £5,000 to £10,000 on a kitchen without doing some due diligence about what one's letting oneself in for. So what I suggest to people is exactly what I did when I undertook the therapy project to solve some specific questions, which is, what is the problem you're seeking to solve? How have you determined that therapy is the answer? What therapy? What are the qualifications of the therapist? What is the method? What is the outcome? What does success mean? How do you measure progress towards success? How long does it go on for before you understand whether or not it's working? It's a big financial decision. The questions one would ask if one were buying a car or as I say, having a kitchen redone. And what's very interesting is a lot of friends of mine who've gone into therapy haven't asked any of those questions at all. Absolutely no idea what they're letting themselves in for. There might be a single personal recommendation, or they've got the number out of a directory. Which suggests a sort of magical thinking about it, as though there are magical properties to everything within the category. But whereas in fact, as one person in this meeting will know, there are some very specific, very targeted strategies which are immensely successful with a really good evidence base. And there are others which are very contra the certain types of therapy, which are very controversial, where the evidence base is much weaker. So the question to a sponsor is, do you know why you're doing this and what you're letting yourself in for? And when I've questioned sponsees who are thinking about this, often the thinking has gone no further than this. Well, I don't feel very good and I'm a year sober now and Susan suggested it. This is not solid thinking. This is wanting to wave a magic wand when you're already in a process. So the first one is to know exactly why you're considering something, what solutions you're considering, how you've identified that therapy is a solution, what type of therapy, what are the credentials, what are the testimonials from that particular therapist. I want to know what I'm getting myself into with things like that. The second question, and this is not often discussed, I've known a lot of people in recovery who see the problem, the entire life problem of the individual, as essentially a psychological problem rooted in childhood experiences. Now, I don't know about anyone else. My experience is that's a factor. I'm not saying it's not a factor. But I think I've identified in my life 8 areas of problem, and each has a different type of solution. And therapy was the solution to one of them, namely the psychological. So there are all sorts of psychological quirks which therapy very much helped with. So I've got a form of autism. And when that was, it was informally diagnosed. It wasn't an autism specialist, but the therapist was experienced with people with autism, and the diagnosis was in the form of if it looks like a duck and it quacks, rather than going through formal diagnostic criteria. But the shoes fit And the approach she adopted was very specifically aimed at looking at certain cognitive processes and working around those in a very tailored way. So a very good example of a psychological problem. Another good example of a psychological problem a friend of mine had, and a therapist was immensely helpful, was being so dissociated he couldn't access any of his feelings. And a therapist in a few weeks managed to unlock everything. And then that really let the, that opened their can of worms. But you need the step four needs, you need to start with the worms. Unless you've got the worms of resentment and fear and guilt and shame on the surface and visible, you've got nothing to work with. I'm sure you've had sponsees who say, I don't resent anyone. I'm a very nice person. And it just means you've probably got someone that's just totally dissociated. And a rather probing therapist can usually put pay to that in a few weeks. So those are examples of psychological problems. People with PTSD, it's a psychological problem where certain events are associated in the mind with certain traumatic events in the past and trigger the same response to those traumatic events of the past as though they're happening right now. And I've experienced that myself. And part of the help I've had from professionals on that is unpacking and unpicking those reactions, and then and that ultimately helped to change those. So it's not that psychological problems don't, cognitive distortions is the other one. I've had friends who've been very much helped with psychotherapists, cognitive behavioral therapists specifically, who look at cognitive distortions like splitting and black and white thinking and catastrophizing, and get people to memorize the checklist and learn to spot them and not buy into them and replace them with different types of thinking. And so all that's immensely helpful. So that's real and true and good and helpful. But that's one aspect of my life. Another aspect of my life is social interaction, how I interact with other people. And I've had huge problems in this area. How do you interact with sponsees? How do you interact with bosses? How do you interact with family? And so that the solution there comes, in my experience, largely from finding people who are functional in those areas and saying, what do you do? How do you have dinner with your mother? Give me five tips. I will write them down. So learning how to, when you've got a boss who shouts, how you handle it. How do you handle HR departments? How do you behave in interviews? How do you deal with the council? And AA is wonderful with these because it gives you a full room of people who can say, well, this is how you deal with the housing authorities. This is how you deal with the people at the job centre. Social interaction. And I know some therapists will focus on this, but it's not the primary focus of therapy, in my experience, to examine very closely how one interacts with others. And some therapists it is, I'm sure, but it's not my experience of therapy. I've had therapy in various forms for many years. It's social problems. The question of, do you have friends? What do you do with those friends? What type of friends are you picking? You've got the social, you've got the practical. All sorts of problems in my life I thought were psychological, but were actually entirely practical. I had all sorts of psychological problems stemming from not having a job and not having any skills which enabled me to get a job. And what I needed in this case was the experience of people that knew how to get me onto the job ladder. And this is not the job of therapy. Physical things. If you've got a dietary problem, you go to a dietitian. If you've got a sleep disorder, you go to a sleep disorder specialist. There are lots of physical things. So we've got the practical, the physical, the social, the psychological. And one needs to go to one's got to identify what the problem is and find the appropriate person to solve that, whether it's inside AA or outside. And then that we haven't even got on to the main ones. There is a moral problem, a spiritual problem, a philosophical problem, and a theological problem. So to go from the back, your relationship to God, your conception of, that's the theological side, your conception of your position in the universe and your relationship with the rest of the universe is a spiritual question. Who are you? Are you a body or are you a spirit? Where are you on those, on the spectrum between the two? It's very broadly the spiritual question. You've got the moral question of, are you for yourself or are you for your contribution to the world? What have we got? We've got moral, so philosophical. So there are lots of philosophical questions which have been immensely relevant. Now, if my problem, I've had problems in all eight areas. And part of my difficulty over the many years that I struggled in recovery was going to one type of practitioner when my problem resided in an entirely different area. Hanging out with assholes, sorry, to pardon my French, is a social issue. And I had terrible problems in my 20s, which actually stemmed from some of the people I was hanging out with. No wonder I was so on. Until I diagnosed what the problem was, I couldn't solve it. The same with lots of physical things. It's amazing how many people in recovery think there's something wrong with them spiritually when they don't have a regular going to bedtime, getting up time. So they're constantly, you know, if you look at your own experience of jet lag, even 2 or 3 hour jet lag, people that work night shifts are all over the place. And a lot of people in recovery will have a terrible relationship with sleep and exercise and then be, and then think that there's a psychological problem. Maybe it's a physical problem. Maybe sort out the low hanging fruit first. I think that to sum this all up, what one's got to do is find the appropriate solution to what the problem is. You've got to find out what the problem is first. And the trouble is with early recovery, first 2 years, 3 years, is until you've done the steps, everything is a mess. So there is no way of really diagnosing specific things that are wrong. One's got to sort of do the general sweep of the steps and sort out the basic things like sleep and diet and exercise and regularity and rhythm in one's life before one can see what's left over. And also, and to go back to the first point, to exercise due diligence about if one goes to outside, expensive outside practitioners, and if so, how to go about it rather than treating it as a magic wand. So anyone have any questions about that whole area? James.
Thank you, Tim. My question is, it's kind of related to this, this is the question. When a sponsee is going to meetings, maybe, or having been through a treatment center or through a therapy process, and is getting or is jumbling up stuff they're hearing in treatment center, etc., or therapists, with the 12-step recovery program as outlined in the AA Big Book, how to keep it on track, if you like? Would you suggest that it's useful to just keep bringing it back to the process in the steps, or spend time discussing alternative or differing views of causes and solutions in recovery, or to just keep bringing it back to the Big Book?
Can you give me an example of where the two things in your experience can conflict?
Okay, so working, so this is a off the top of my head example. So working with a sponsee going through the through step one and having to unpick the or to look at the idea of just not drinking and going to meetings in and of itself is not the solution to alcoholism, because that's what they've been told maybe previously, that that's the problem and that's the solution. If you just don't drink and go to meetings, then everything should be fine. And having
I think you've got two distinct issues there.
Yeah.
The first issue, which is maybe a sort of therapy specific issue, is And this is a very, very difficult one to resolve. And I'm going to try and say this as respectfully as possible, but you know me, you know the chances of me being able to do that are frankly remote. There is a current in society at the moment where if you feel it, it is real and it's happened. I was having a conversation with John. I've told you this story before. I was having a conversation with Jonathan a few months ago where I was losing. And so to press my point, I thought in a winning way, I said, but it's my lived experience. And he said, yes, but that doesn't mean it's real. Now, the tightrope here is to acknowledge the feelings are obviously real. I mean, if you feel something, you are feeling something. But the notion that if you felt something, it is an authentic reflection of what has happened, that's the contentious point. And sometimes people are not open to being challenged on their perception of what happened. The Katie Parker puts this very well. She's even rougher than I am. I remember her at State Line many years ago. She sort of quotes a sort of apocryphal conversation with the sponsee, where the sponsee says I want to talk about my feelings, and the sponsor says your feelings come from a delusional mindset. Let's talk about delusion. Now, there are kinder ways of doing it than that. So I think one acknowledges the feelings and says, but are you open to challenging your own perception and interpretation of what happened? Are you willing to separate the physical events which happened in the material world from the story that you, the narrative you've told yourself about? Now, I never got the narrative challenged with outside practitioners. In fact, the narrative we worked with the narrative as though the narrative was the reflection of reality. So that's an example of where you're doing something which is entirely different. Sometimes I've had sponsees who've been encouraged to get angry with and express that anger towards and confront friends and relatives with what they perceive to be their poor behavior. Unfortunately, this just goes against the program. So now I'm not saying the program is right and that practitioner is wrong, but there are times when you have to say to the sponsee, matey, you're going to have to pick a horse to ride because you can't ride these two horses. I've had lots of sponsees who perfectly successfully had therapy, married the two. As I've said in a previous talk, what you don't want to do is to be reconciling the two. So what I get if they're having therapy, say, you leave the therapy over there. We're gonna do this just as a standalone thing. It is not my job to, if you want to do two systems at once, that's fine, but you're going to have to do the reconciling. I'm not here to be played off against the therapist and vice versa, or to reconcile the two systems. You're just going to have to figure that one out on your own. And people manage. People, if they want to, they find a way. So that's the sort of conflict between therapy, for instance, or other practitioners and AA. You get a similar thing with religion and AA, by the way, exactly the same type of conflicts. What you're talking about more specifically there, though, however, is having to unpick before you actually build up. And the simplest way to do it is to, a sponsee who shall remain nameless many years ago, who when whatever you said, they would say back, but you said 2 weeks ago, but I heard at Sober in Shoreditch, but my last sponsor said, but I heard on television, but Judge Judy said, like constantly citing what someone else has said, even using what you said back against you. And that won't do. You just have no. This is where the set aside prayer comes in. So you say everything you've learned so far, lots of it is great because it's got you to where you are now. So hooray. But what we're going to have to do is just quietly set the whole thing aside. Start with a blank sheet of paper. Anything you've previously learned, which is true and helpful, will be returned to you as part of this process. So you're not going to lose anything by setting aside. What you're going to do is simply put it on the shelf and leave it there. And then when you get to the end of the process, you can look back at the shelf and say, what can I reclaim from previous processes or learnings or lessons? And sometimes as you're in the process, sometimes things fall into place that you learned before. But what you have to clear the ground first. If the pot is full, you can't put anything in the pot. So you need to clear the pot first. And then you'll have absolutely, if they're willing to do that, you'll have absolutely no trouble. Sara Rivka.
Hi, yeah, thanks. Well, first, you already just answered part of my question, but the other part of the question is, it was very interesting to hear you describe the different kinds of therapies, you know, different things that might be, therapy might be helpful for. But I'm just wondering, I don't want to say why you said, why were you saying all that? is it so that is this information so that if I'm sponsoring somebody, is this for if somebody comes to me and says, should I go to a therapist? And then I could, you know, say back to them similar things to what you said, or is that just stuff that you know? I just wasn't sure exactly what I'm supposed to do with that.
The reason why is because I've had extensive experiences over many years. I don't really have them anymore because I sort of solve the problem before I get there, where people are doing very well and then they join some other external program, maybe a religious program, or they adopt a therapy approach, and the AA activity dwindles. The stuff they're learning in therapy can sometimes undermine their trust in AA. There is only a certain number of hours in the week. And so, especially if people are working and they have other commitments, necessarily it's going to double or treble the time it takes to get through the steps, particularly if they're given lots of homework. And they're trying to adopt often two entire worldviews at the same time. And what happens is they can't adopt either fully. And if they drink again, they may die. So this is a very important question. What are you going to... I've had it the other way around. I've had sponsees or people, but newcomers, whose PTSD is so extreme. Frankly, my feeling is that unless they get the psychiatric and psychological and psychotherapeutic help first, they won't be able to do the AA program. They need to be brought back to reality before they can, the AA's measures can be of much use. So go to meetings, fine, but maybe go and sort some of that stuff out before you do any really detailed stuff in the steps. Maybe do, get a sort of daily program in place. But let's not go anywhere near your childhood until you've had it looked at by a psychotherapist. It's because so often when people are trying to do both at once, they do neither properly, and it can destroy their ability to recover. And that's why it's such a critical thing. If it's going to be done, it should be done diligently and carefully and in response to a specific situation, not waving a magic wand. And so this is not to interfere with their process. It's to encourage them to take maximum responsibility for making sure that what they're doing is deliberate and thought through. So you're not guiding them to do it or not to do it. You're giving them the tools to make an informed decision about what they're doing. Does that make sense, Orica?
Yeah, it does. And I know that sometimes I've had the question put to me by a sponsee who's having a hard time, and they'll say to me, do you think I need therapy? And what I really think that they need to do is to take some of the suggestions that I've been given them, been giving them, and like to actually do them. But therapy seems to be an easier, softer way. I'm not talking about somebody who's like, you know, suicidal or freaking out or something. I'm talking about just, it's people who don't really, you know, seem to be doing their AA homework. And it's just frustrating. Like, yeah, go ahead, see a therapist. But then what do you want from me? I don't know.
Well, yeah, so that's the point. So that's very helpful, because that's a very concrete situation. So my response in that situation is, you've already started something. Why not finish the thing you've started and then see if you still have a problem? Because you haven't tested yet whether AA is going to work on this unless you complete the first 9 steps and live in the 10, 11 and 12 for a good couple of years afterwards. It takes 2 or 3 years after completing the first 9 steps to get a real feel for what effect it has. It doesn't take straight away. It doesn't clear everything up straight away. He's a lot of patience with this. Even Dr. Bob craved alcohol for a number of years. So I think that's the response. That's the response there. I've had therapists who give me lots of homework to do. Now, if they're not, if they've come to AA and are not doing the homework, the question is, if you go to a therapist, will you do their homework? Why do you think you'd be doing their homework when you're not doing the AA? And that's a really legitimate question to ask. So is this, are you doing this because you think it's going to be more effective, or are you doing it as a way of avoiding what's in front of you here? So I think there's some very serious questions when you've got someone who's going full throttle in AA and there's stuff that's just not shifting. Absolutely. Look, you know, you've got to diagnose what's wrong and find a solution within AA, the world of spirituality, the world of religion, the world of therapy, whatever. But you can't test, you can't diagnose something when the acute problem has not been sorted out. Seamus, I think you were next.
Oh, there we go. I'm muted. Thank you, Tim. Hello, everybody. I think I'll ask this question by way of a case study. So it's someone I have in mind who, when I first met him, I kind of picked him up from another sponsor who had drunk. So the guy was drifting. By the time I met him, he had a history of interludes in his drinking, as did I, actually. It was part of my history as well, time off. 6 years off in my case, and quite a long time off in his, during which time in his case, he had become depressed and he had sought help with his depression. He'd gone to an expensive psychiatrist, I think, and been treated. And what he'd been treated with was pills. I don't know exactly what, but sort of fairly heavy duty antidepressants, which seemed to have done the trick. And then there was the drinking. So he started drinking again. And for that, he came to me. He worked the steps. He did what I thought was a fairly creditable workmanlike job on step 4, and seemed to be getting the results. I think he wanted to stop drinking more because of what happened when he drank than for any more fundamental existential reason. He was getting consequences that were bad for his family life, for his professional career. It was that kind of thing. He felt that he needed to stop, and we provided him with a way of stopping. After a few years of this, he started drinking again intermittently and has never really succeeded in stopping that. Also had another bout of so-called depression, back to the psychiatrist, changed the medication, all right now, kind of thing. Incidentally, I always forget to ask the medication question up front. I'm always kicking myself, thinking, oh God, I wish I'd asked them what pills they're on. Because, you know, you can bet your bottom dollar, but half of them are on some kind of pill. And I wish I knew that. But there's a final strand to this, which it's just been surfaced actually by something that you said, which is religion. So the guy's also got religion, and he's got the kind of religion where if enough people get together and pray to God, God kind of rearranges the universe in their favor, you know, in response to lobbying. It's a bit like in Bruce Almighty, where, you know, a lot of people pray to win the lottery and Bruce gets fed up and he presses the yes to all button on the prayer management system. It's that kind of view of, yeah, prayer as an exercise in lobbying the Almighty. I feel sorry for this guy, but I don't really know what to say beyond what I've said already, which is trying to draw attention to the, you know, the nature of prayer and our relationship with the divine within this program, and trying to communicate by one means or another. I don't think that depression is a separate problem, kind of like over here, but actually part of the same problem. One problem needing one solution rather than two problems needing several solutions. So it's kind of like a big question mark. What would you do faced with a situation like this if you wanted to try and help this guy out of the mess he's in?
That's a very, very helpfully put scenario. I've actually got parked as a separate question, the question of psychiatry, because it's an entirely different topic than psychotherapy. Because it's a medical question. And then you've got the question of medication as well. So I'm parking the psychiatric medical side of it just for the moment. C.S. Lewis talks very interestingly, I think it's in Mere Christianity, about the case of two men who don't want to fight in the First World War with and have got terrible psychological blocks against being soldiers, essentially. And both of them go and see a psychiatrist or a psychologist or someone to help them with these psychological blocks. And both of them have these psychological blocks resolved and removed. And one of them says, this is marvelous. Now I've got my psychological blocks removed, I can fight for my country. And then the second one says, well, that's great. Now I've got those blocks removed, I can be more adept in avoiding fighting for my country. I'm now much more in control of myself. And how the psychological question is a different question than the moral question. Now, obviously, depression is widely considered to fall squarely within the domain of psychology and or medicine. But I'll tell you something anecdotally. Living an immoral and materialistic life made me depressed, quite aside from other factors. I've had periods of my life where I would be very, very spiritual, doing lots in AA, sponsoring lots of people, doing all of the right stuff. And over a period of time, my behavior became selfish. I'd started to harm other people through deceitful action. And I became very materialistic. Basically money, romance, sex, appearance. And I became profoundly depressed as a result, profoundly depressed. I think it's true to say that, certainly in my case, and that's not the only cause, physical things can do it as well. Physical illness has done it for me in the past as well. I had very, very bad depression when I was growing up. What I've discovered in my case is that there was a strong moral and spiritual component in my depression, also a philosophical one, my philosophical attitude towards the universe. When those things, when the social, when the practical problems which are not being faced, you put all of those together, you will, my first sponsor, so people know me for quoting this, my first sponsor, who was a doctor, actually, Doug. I said to him, I'm depressed. He said, you're not depressed. Your life is depressing. If I lived your life, I'd be depressed as well. So although it's very clear and it's very well documented, you can go and read it on Wikipedia, that there are organic causes of depression. And certainly it takes on a life of it. It can take on a life of its own. It becomes a self-propagating phenomenon, you know, where people will avoid other people. They'll retreat from life, and that will actually exacerbate the depression, and it become and all sorts of things happen with diet and sleep, and that makes things worse. So I think you've got two separate questions with extreme psychological conditions, whether they're anxiety or depression or panic attacks, which I suffered very badly from, is you've got the acute treatment of the problem and then identification of the underlying cause. And if you take someone with a good childhood, this is my observation of friends of mine in AA who report this, they reported themselves a good childhood, no psychological hang-ups, but years of living in a way which is dysfunctional from a material, a practical, a physical, a social, a philosophical, a religious, a moral, and a spiritual point of view. And though you will generate the same surface condition as someone with a very traumatic childhood, they present the same way. So in my case, I only worked out where the depression came from by addressing not just the psychological, but addressing those other areas, the practical, the social, the physical, the moral, the spiritual, the philosophical, and the religious, until the jigsaw puzzle, as I dealt with those one by one, some things caused the depression to lift more quickly than others. I thought, aha, well, that was a large component of it. So I always encourage people to look at everything, to look at this holistically, not to treat one aspect like, if I pray, it will go away. If I do service, it will go away. If I get enough exercise, it will go away. If I examine my childhood, it will go away. Maybe, but maybe there are all of the areas involved that need to be looked at. So to look at everything, to treat it as a 10-year project, not a 5-minute project, and be systematic about examining each of those eight areas, inventorying each of those eight areas, and finding people who are super functional in each of those areas, and to copy what they're doing and see if that helps. And so it's really empirically that I've done this. It's not based on any sort of theory. It's simply by trying things and discovering that they work. And I was someone that was told in my teens that I would likely I'm the sort of person that would probably be ill forever and have to be under sort of medical psychological supervision forever because my case was so extreme. So this is not coming from someone that's sort of tripping through the tulips their whole life and is looking askance at people with entirely different problems. This is from someone that's been in that position. When I was at school, I was on suicide watch for 5 years, where people were charged secretly. I only discovered this afterwards, secretly with surveilling me and writing reports, which are then collated weekly and sent to my parents. My mother, of course, has wiped all memory of this. She said, oh, you had an idyllic childhood. She's conveniently forgotten all of this. So this is, as I say, not coming from a Pollyanna-ish attitude. It's come from having to really knock on every possible door to solve the problem of depression, anxiety, panic attacks, and other disagreeable manifestations. I do want to say something about the psychiatry question, which is even thornier. Harry, do you want to come in with your question?
Yeah, it's a bit of a spoke-off. Shall I just go with it, though? Yes. Okay, I'll take that as a yes. Okay, so the question was, so someone's got something of a program you described, and then let's say they're not feeling, they're feeling unhappy, and then therapy comes up as a potential magic fix for this. But what you made me think of was, often my sponsees will, rather than say, I'm going to go see a therapist, they'll say, I need to go through the work again. So I don't know if you've got that as a topic to come up, like when, what are the guide rails for coming back onto the work? And because like, all of them have just almost immediately wanted to do it again, which I don't know if reflects my sponsorship.
I'm going to do that in about 2 minutes' time. I'm going to say two things about psychiatry. I've had lots of sponsees who, you know, my first question I ask is, are you taking your medication? you know, I'm not one of these people, you know, there are people in recovery that say you shouldn't take things. I'm the other way around. If they're on antipsychotics, I want to be, you know, this is my first question. Are you still taking your antipsychotics? The one thing I would say about there is a type of alcoholic who will treat them, and I've sponsored them sometimes, who treat themselves essentially not as human beings, but as chemistry sets. So that every problem is looking for a chemical solution. Now, I don't know whether that's the case or not. What I do observe is that people with that profile struggle with the not drinking bit of the program on a regular basis. Dr. Paul O is great on this subject. So there is a question with the psychiatrist hunting, which is a whole hobby that some people engage in, that they're constantly looking for new psychiatrists and new diagnoses and new prescriptions. And I know almost nothing about that area. What I observe is it very often combined with a resistance to the program. So it's looking for something which is in, so that the purpose is not to learn how to live well. The purpose is to feel better, and whatever means achieve that end is fine. Now, I don't think that's a bad approach. It's just not my approach. And so if people's approach is simply they just want to feel better, they don't care how, totally welcome in AA, do whatever you want. But that I approach things very, very differently. My job is to learn how to live well and have my emotional state as a consequence of that. And I think there's a fundamental philosophical question there. And it's good to have a sponsor you're aligned with on that. I don't think there's a right or wrong answer to that philosophical question. But it is important for the sponsor and sponsee to be aligned. Otherwise, you're just going to have terrible arguments the whole time. I will say one thing. There was an AA member in Bristol who is a philosopher. His job is he gets paid remarkably for being a philosopher. And he goes around, one of the things he does, he goes around to schools and he says to the kids, he does thought experiments with them. That's one of his ways in which he introduces people to philosophy. He's sober very many years. And one of his thought experiments is this. You've got two options. The first option is to go through life, and is this to 7-year-olds and 8-year-olds, to go through life feeling everything that life has to throw at you. So you'll have joy, you'll have pleasure, you'll have apathy, you'll have numbness, you'll have anxiety at times, you'll have depression at times. There'll be times you want to die. There'll be times that you're immensely happy and you can't understand why a year ago, 5 years ago, things looked so bleak. You have the full range of human experience. Option number one. Option number two, we can put you in a room. We can hook you up to a machine with a virtual reality headset, which gives you a happy dream and plug into your arm a drip, which ensures that you are consistently happy for the rest of your life. You won't have any friends. You won't do anything. But you'll have presented to you in the virtual reality headset a story, which is pleasant, and the chemicals will ensure that you are happy forever. Which do you pick? But you can't. You're not living. You're not doing anything of normal life. You're just in the room. And he's done this with thousands of children. Not one has chosen the machine. It's a fascinating, it's anecdotal. I mean, it's just one person with their own experience of, but it's a very interesting one. I bet in AA, I'd love to do this. Whether you'd get the same response. I think you might be evenly split. And that's a philosophical question. Why am I here? Am I here to feel good or am I here to live life? On the question of, yes, I need to go through the work again. Oh, by the way, one point with the psychiatry thing. I've got a little worksheet that my sponsor put around some doctor friends of his, which basically says, here are some classes of drugs which some AA members have experience of leading to relapse. So if you're going to take these, maybe you want to disclose the fact you're a doctor, you're an alcoholic, an addict to the doctor or the anaesthetist or the surgeon or the whoever, and discuss how these are going to be dealt with. And that's a very helpful thing because it helps people make informed decisions. So you're not making a decision for them. You're putting them in a position that they can make an intelligent, informed decision with the professionals that are helping them. But your question, Harry, but I want to go through the work again. So in recovery world, it goes through different phases. For a while, the catchphrase was, I need a new experience. I need a new experience. And it's not so much in AA. I don't know. I think AA is just lethargic, but CA is deadly for this. There's always a new method. It usually starts in Toronto or Liverpool. No one knows why, where someone devises a new way of going through the big book. And then suddenly everyone's got these sponsors in Liverpool or everyone's got these sponsors in Toronto. And it's all the new method and all the other methods are wrong. So CA is that, if I dare say this, is deadly for the New Jerusalem constantly being builded on some hill of a new method of going through the big book. I'm extremely skeptical about all of this. When do you need to go through the work again? If you've had a little drink or a little drug, you probably want to go back to the beginning of the steps again. If you haven't been to AA since the Callahan government, you might want to go through the steps again. If you went through the steps in an incredibly shoddy way before or went through with four different sponsors, you want to go through it again. If you've had a nervous breakdown or maybe two nervous breakdowns or three nervous breakdowns, maybe. So there are extreme situations where it's necessary. If you're working very hard in AA and you're really hitting a brick wall, fine. But my suspicion in a lot of cases, people want to go through the work again without having completed the work the first time and without sponsoring other people. So the aim, it's as though you're going to sort of get some special spiritual tools or people talk about going through the steps at greater depth. I'm skeptical about what that even means. It's like developing a deeper relationship with my higher power. I literally do not know what that, I just don't know what any of that means. I give you an example of what I mean by this. I don't think it's about depth. If you've got someone who's 6 weeks sober and they admit that they lie a lot, and cheat and think very resentful, hateful thoughts about people, and are frightened a lot and feel guilty about the things they've done in the past. I don't think that is any less deep than someone who is 20 years sober and saying the same things. I don't think it's deeper because you're sober longer. If something is fully true, at 6 weeks sober, it is as deep as anything. And I think we're doing a terrible injustice to people in their first year by suggesting that they're not doing it deeply. And that, you know, if they go through the steps every year for 20 years, then they'll get some depth. But all they're doing is peeling the first layer of the onion. There's this sort of endless onion peeling. I'm, as I think, extremely skeptical about that. I've known people in their first year who are as spiritual as anything when it comes to letting go and being of service. And real depth is when today, if I go through the day not thinking about myself, just fully engaged in the world around me and kind of grateful and cheerful, that's as deep as it gets. And in A Course in Miracles, it says that there is no hierarchy of illusions, which means something which is all things which are untrue are equally untrue. So it's not that some are more untrue than others. And where this applies to the steps and this notion of depth, the steps don't find out what's true and real. They find out all of the blocks to what is true and real in order for those blocks to be removed. And then what is true and real, which is innocence and peace and all of those things, just shows up. You know, that the Michelangelo and David, I don't know if it's a true story, but they said, how did you carve the statue of David? And he said, well, mate, I'll tell you how I did it. I got a chisel, got me block of marble, I chipped away everything that wasn't David. And now I've got David, look, yeah. I don't believe it any more than you do. But it's a great story, because I think that's what the steps do. We chip away everything that's not us. Now, if you're very complicated and neurotic and you're 20 or 30 years sober, and you write about all of the illusory BS in your head, that's no more deep, because it's unreal. It has no more substance than the illusions of a newcomer that believes arrant nonsense about the person sitting next to them at the meeting. Their illusions are illusions. And the idea that some illusions are deeper than others. So there are lots of situations where people need to go through the steps again, and that's fine. But to treat going through the first 9 steps as a solution to spiritual malaise, I think is wrongheaded. I think what one should, what's more useful is to really be practicing 10, 11 and 12 in a diligent, consistent way on a daily basis. Try that for a couple of years and see what happens. And you can always, if you want to go back, if you find that there's a particular relationship with a person or a situation which is problematical, then you can do steps 4 through 9 on that situation in 3 hours, because you've learned how to do the method now. But what people want to do is like another 9-month process of staring at themselves and poring over the book and poring over the meaning of this. And that's what I think you're right to be, absolutely right to be skeptical about that, Harry. I didn't cover any of the topics I meant to cover.
Does anyone else have any questions for Tim?
Will you do exercise next week?
So what I've got left is exercise, drama, families, and workplace. And I think that's it then. Although, you know what? I'm just going to say one thing, because the exercise thing is a tiny topic. Let's just kill that one now. It's very straightforward. I don't know how to be spiritually well and mentally well without being physically well. It's not that it solves all my problems, but by God, it helps with so many things. And as I said earlier, I don't think it needs to be belaboured. I think it's broader than just exercise. It's physical health. You're looking at sleep, diet, sugar, caffeine, nicotine, exercise. And lots of friends report this as well, that when any of those 6 are out of whack, good luck being spiritual, good luck being emotionally balanced. You get those in whack, And it's amazing how many psychological problems just evaporate, how many other difficulties just cease to be difficulties. So I wouldn't underestimate those. And I try and encourage sponsees, even when they're very new, to start looking at those and getting some sanity in place. That's all I have to say about physical things. And now it's 8 o'clock.
Thanks, Tim. Anyone, any questions on exercise? The physical.
Would you count phone use and media and stuff as part? It seems like the same as sleep to me, like digital hygiene.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish mine were better. But yeah, that's absolutely a question. Where very often when you've got people that can't get done during the day, all the stuff they need to get done to get their program sorted out, to get their life sorted out, to get their work sorted out, very often it's because between 10 o'clock at night and 1 o'clock in the morning, it's all Netflix and WhatsApp. That's why everything else is out of whack. You get that sorted out and suddenly then they can get to the 7 a.m. meeting and then everything else just falls out automatically. So yeah, as with everything in recovery, pick the low hanging fruit first and sort those out and then see where you are. And you'd be amazed at how many simple measures will massively improve the person's quality of life. Because they've never been taught these things.
Thank you, Tim. I think that seems an appropriate juncture. And so we will be on next week with those topics. Okay, great. With that, I'll actually hand the meeting back to you, Tim, to close with the Serenity Prayer.
Thank you. And if anyone can think of other topics in between them, feel free to message me. And if you don't have my, or don't write my number down in time, then Alistair and she'll be happy to receive those questions. So would you please help me close with a Serenity Prayer? God,
grant me the serenity. Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Courage to change the things I can. And the wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Bye.